Hello, and welcome to On the Job, where we take you into the lives and careers of Canadians. I'm your host, Chelsea Aleche.
And I'm Melissa Verge. Today on the show, yup, that's the sound of fried chicken being made. We take you inside of one of Toronto's most popular fried chicken restaurants. That's where we meet the proud Canadian who's determined to make his business stand out in the industry.
We then bring you behind the closed doors of a military base in a quiet Manitoba town. Young and eager to be deployed, we meet the soldiers of Canadian Forces Base Shiloh.
A battle buddy or fire team partner, you know the insides and outsides of their lives. Everything about them, you know it.
Later on in the show, we tackle sexism in the workplace, exploring what it was like for a woman to join Canada's correctional services in the 1970s.
When I became a superintendent, all of my colleagues in all the other prisons were men. My boss in those days never called me by my name. He always called me Sunshine.
And then, we show you what it takes to climb the competitive ladder of the media industry today.
100% is like an understatement. You have to devote your life to this. Basically, once you're in, you're in.
But first, we take you inside Canada's largest mining conference, which every year attracts geologists and investors from all over the world. Reporter Alexa Daddario sat down with Nick Findler to dig a little deeper into the nuclear energy industry.
Nick Findler was just like any other young 20-something. He finished college and wasn't sure what to do next. Nuclear energy is slowly becoming more and more popular, with some hoping for what's called the nuclear renaissance.
So it was a number of years ago. I was doing quite a bit of research on nuclear, and I'd had some friends and some family members talking about it in a pretty negative light, right? So I wanted to find out how negative it really was. And you look at countries like France. So France is one of the world leaders in nuclear. About 80% of their energy mix is actually derived from nuclear. They have not only the cheapest but the cleanest energy in all the world. Right, you look at Germany, which is supposed to be this green haven, right? France is half of the carbon emissions per person that Germany is. So it's really a great way to make clean energy. And I saw this opportunity after Fukushima hit that, we just had this decimated industry where, just about every company had died.
Events like Fukushima and Chernobyl were devastating, but they were anomalies. Canada gets 16% of its energy from nuclear, with a projected increase under the current administration. Nuclear energy does much more good, or does it? Is nuclear power safe?
My name is Doug Briggy. I'm a professor at Tufts University School of Medicine in public health. My research is mostly in occupational environmental health, and in recent years, a lot of that has been environmental health, frankly. There was this whole idea of a nuclear renaissance and that they were going to build a lot of nuclear reactors. It hasn't happened. Instead, we see Japan have most of its reactors closed. Germany's closing down its reactors. Italy has decided not to pursue nuclear power. In the U.S. even, which has a large number of reactors, they're closing down a couple and they're building a couple. There's no great expansion of nuclear power, and that is driven more by economics than anything else.
With carbon taxes being implemented on Canadian citizens, many are hoping this helps fund the nuclear sector. Nick Findler is among them, as well as the CEO, Jordan Trimble, of the new firm where he works, Sky Harbor Resources.
Yeah, I mean, look, the mainstream media has given it a bad rap. You've seen, obviously, in particular in the last 30, 40 years, there's been two notable nuclear disasters. Fukushima is the one that is topical today because it happened recently at Chernobyl a few decades ago. But the reality of it is, as I said, it's CO2 free electricity. The new reactors coming online, these Generation 3 reactors, they're much larger. They consume more uranium. They're much, much safer, right? So we've come a long way. You got to remember these two, Chernobyl and Fukushima, these were Generation 1 reactors. Fukushima actually was supposed to be decommissioned 2 years before the disaster happened. And keep in mind that disaster, you had the tsunami, you had two backup generators that failed at the reactor that were supposed to flood the core to prevent the meltdown. So really it was an unfortunate, obviously it was a disaster. It was very unfortunate. lot of hard lessons learned for the industry. But going forward, again, in places like China and India, a huge issue there right now is pollution, right? I mean, if you look at some of the mega cities in China, in particular Beijing, you know, it can be a bright sunny day and 20 minutes later, you can barely see 20 feet in front of you because of the smog that comes in. People are literally choking on the air there. And so nuclear is going to be an important part of that, the solution. If you just look last year at COP21 in Paris, nuclear has to be a part of that solution.
There's been three events in history that have been catastrophic, right? You've had Fukushima most recently, then you had Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, right? So these were all horrific events. But what's interesting is that, you know, there's plane crashes and there's oil spills, and obviously you want to do whatever you can to avoid those disasters, right? But on a nuclear CO2 free, it's so abundant in energy, right? So you look at one barrel of uranium gives you the same amount of energy as 40,000 barrels of oil. So you look at a carbon footprint. The carbon footprint for nuclear is much less than wind, much less than solar, because the actual process of creating the windmills and, you know, the solar panel is actually not the cleanest process. So, you know, the way that I look at it, in a utopian world, you probably have, you know, 30, 40, 50% nuclear and then the rest being renewables. But, you know, I think you look at a country like China, right, that's suffering huge pollution problems. They've put nuclear on the forefront of their plan. They've got 14 new reactors coming online just in China alone this year in 2017.
Obviously, nuclear power is a great idea in places like China and India. As for Canada, however, an increase is projected, and that may not be such a bad idea, so long as alternatives become just a little more mainstream as well. In Toronto, I'm Alexa Daddario.
David Almania, the subject of our next segment, knew from a young age that he wanted to serve his country. Growing up in the Philippines, he looked up to the soldiers in his community. Today, he is a member of the Canadian Armed Forces, eagerly awaiting battle. My co-host, Melissa, recently visited Manitoba CFB Shiloh. She gives us a look into the life of a Canadian soldier who has yet to go to war.
Meet David, a 21-year-old infantry soldier in the Canadian Armed Forces. He's been in the military for a year. The main reason why David Almonia decided to join was because he saw the benefits they were having in his home country of the Philippines. He remembers seeing them helping out with humanitarian aid when he was just a young boy. Looking back on that moment, he still remembers thinking that he would not settle for anything less than being a soldier. He was 7 years old when he moved to Canada.
You know, there's lots of stuff going around the Philippines of people may heard. But yeah, I mean, just a bunch of army dudes walk up in uniform just helping other people, you know. It doesn't have to be extraordinary, like, oh, you know, they were in battle, you know, and all that. But just normal stuff, you know, just to get people going along with their day.
Almonia was working in a glass factory before becoming a soldier. He says when he first submitted his application, he wasn't sure if he was going to hear anything back from the recruiters.
Honestly, I didn't really expect it. I just threw in my papers, not knowing, because I heard the process, you know, and all that. But I mean, I just threw it in, and then one day they randomly called me up, like, hey, you know, you're in.
One of the duties Almonia has to keep up with as a soldier is making sure his boots are polished at all times. Sometimes he will spend 4 hours on them. When they are finished, the boots should be so shiny that you can see a reflection in them.
See, the boots they gave us, we have to keep polished at all times. Regularly, we would polish them here and then, even though we're not going on what we call parades, where we have to march in them. They have to be up to standard with keeping it shine, keeping it ready to go whenever they need us to. But they're not up to par then. Well, think of it. Let's say you're in front of a group of guys. You're in front of a group of, you know, 200 other people. And, you know, yours would stand out compared to the rest of them. if they're not shiny enough, so.
Right now, David lives in the military barracks in Shiloh, Manitoba. It's a big change from the city of Manila in the Philippines, where he grew up. Ammonia says he remembers it was crowded and dirty. Now, he lives in a one-strip mall, two-gas station town with just the bare necessities. It's a little like a university dorm inside his living quarters. The shower stalls and the bathroom are all lined up next to each other and painted a sickly dark green. The windows in the stairwell have bars across them and give the impression of a prison. His room is plain, and there is no real sense of who lives here. It could be anyone. But Ammonia doesn't seem to mind his living situation.
Personally, yeah, I'm gonna live here for a while until I can afford to find a house or rent a house or something like that. Like I said, we have the necessities with what we got, so. Bathrooms are fine. I mean, we have hot water, which is nice. It's not that hard. If you want privacy, keep your door closed more or less. But yeah, it's. I mean, you have like 200 guys with you. You know, if you want to hang out and find someone to talk to, it's not that hard.
Although the training was hard, now he has a lot of spare time on his hands. Sometimes he finishes day at 12. Some days they tell him not to bother coming in. Every Friday is an early day. The job that they are trained for is battle, and here in Shiloh, Manitoba, the only real battle is the one on Ammonia's TV screen. A lot of his time is spent in his room playing war video games.
Hit X.
Release hell.
Oh, okay, that's cool. Kill him, whatever.
Honestly, video games has been with me since I was a kid. So, I've always liked playing video games. I don't know if I'll ever go out of it, but who knows.
One of the people David works closely with is Samuel Elslam, who is also his fire team partner.
Fire team partner is kind of like your buddy you rely on in situations. It's, I'd say, like a coworker, but a lot closer to them than a coworker, because a battle buddy or fire team partner, you know the insides and outsides of their lives, everything about them, you know it. Getting ready for work and stuff in the morning, we would make sure that each of his weapons laid out properly, beds are made the way they're supposed to be made. We have all our gear for the day. He's always there to make sure I'm good to go and other people too, not just your fire team partner. He's looking out for everyone else.
Gokru says when it comes down to doing what they may eventually have to do, face real battle, he knows Ammonia will have his back.
I know he can get me out of it. If I was ever shot and I couldn't walk, he'd just get me out. I know that.
Despite the dangers, Ammonia is looking forward to when he gets the opportunity to be deployed. That's his job, he says. Otherwise, it's like practicing your entire life for a game you never get to play in. In Toronto, I'm Melissa Verge.
So Melissa, what was it like being on the base?
It was a little bit like a university dorm inside the living quarters. The whole base is like a town in itself. If you wanted to, you'd never have to leave. You can go shopping, buy everything you need there. So, up next, we head to a bustling kitchen in the heart of Toronto to hear about what it's like to run one of the city's most popular fried chicken restaurants. Reporter Matthew Chin went to the Dirty Bird near Bathurst and Bloor to learn about how they set themselves apart from other fried chicken joints.
When you think of fried chicken, the first thing that comes to mind is the frying, the crispy skin, and the maple sugar. At first it may seem like an odd pairing, the sweet with the savory, not to mention a little kick of heat, but at the Dirty Bird in Toronto, they are serving fried chicken with a hint of Canadian sweetness they're calling Northern Fried. Here is Josh Scott, the co-owner, explaining what Northern Fried means.
We really want to focus on something northern, right? So that's what we came up with, Northern Fried, as opposed to Southern Fried. We wanted to be Northern Fried, right? We're up north for Canada. And with that, we wanted to take some derivatives of maple and kind of incorporate that into the chicken. But that kind of gives it our twist. It's finished with that northern spice, and that's what kind of we've been come to be known for.
The restaurant first opened in Kensington Market at the beginning of March 2015.
You know, when we picked Kensington Market, it's funny, it wasn't even originally on our top three list, and then that location came up and we all kind of went, yeah, that's the one. You know, it works, and it ended up being really great to us. When we first went there, a lot of people were like, oh, be careful, winters are really tough in the market, not a lot of business. But that winter of 2015, we had really good weather, and we just had a really good winter. Like, it sustained very well until the spring, and then summer was really good. And, like, Kensington is just a monster. We wish we had 10 different Kensingtons in Toronto, because it's a great spot. Really quick, right? Before we knew it, we were looking at like signs going up, the menu going up, and we're like, wow, like it happened in under a year from when we kind of formed the company. So it was pretty crazy. And I mean, opening the doors on Friends and Family night definitely felt pretty crazy. We had lineups out the door the whole night, and you know, Friends and Family, and then it became anybody that was in the market was just like, whoa, what's going on here? So we had, you know, our friends or family there, and then we just had randoms that were just trying to get in to get a taste before anybody else, which was really cool.
Since then, the process has remained relatively the same. Dredge, fry, then sprinkle with maple sugar.
And right out of the fryer, while it's still hot, that's when you hit it. We hit it with that maple blend, and it kind of sticks to it, right? You almost want, like, if you were taking regular sugar and you threw it on something hot, it melts, right? So it kind of sticks to it and gives it that crispy sweetness. Yeah.
The trick to getting the best flavors is to get the best possible ingredients. Scott and his other partners make an effort to buy locally sourced ingredients from places they trust, despite the added costs.
We've had to up our orders a little bit, so now we're not just going to across the street, especially with opening this, right? So it's good to use people like that. We could go to another huge company, we could go to a major company and probably save a little bit of money, you know what I mean? But we don't know, we know exactly what's going on here. We know where they get the birds from, we know how they butcher it. It's butchered how we want it. It's halal by hand. It's not done with a machine. So we know what we're getting, and so we still have our local guys, but it's not as it was when we first opened Kensington. We were just that only small one.
And it's that kind of quality product which makes Dirty Bird cook Rashawn Farquharson enjoy working and eating here.
We always have like key quality to it compared to other places that have fried chicken. Like, let's say if you go to KFC, Popeyes, or any other restaurants, like those are fast food chains that sort of specialize in chicken, but it's not as good quality of chicken as the Dirty Bird, which I really appreciate about it. So whenever I come in and I can eat it, it's like, I'm not gonna be eating chicken like from Popeyes or KFC where it's too much oil, it's too oily and whatnot.
For Jackie Toledo, a chef manager, the recipes are what makes the restaurant stand out.
I think it's different, but it's a little bit, like, the recipe, like, it's, like, innovative. Like, what they've done with it is very different from whatever's out there. Because they did a lot of research, right, before starting this place or, like, you know, creating this menu. So it's pretty different from what you see out there. So I guess that's why people like it, because it's something they're not used to. So people get really attached.
And no one is more attached to the Dirty Bird than Scott is.
When you're the owner and, you know what I mean, your bank account is attached to the business, I mean, it changes everything, right? Like, it's different going to work for somebody, but when you're going to work for yourself, it's a totally different ballgame. You'll spend 16, 18 hour days on no sleep. You'll just do what you have to do to get something done. Not that I wasn't too tired when I was working for somebody else, but I mean, it's different when it's your business.
And right? Do you regret any of that?
No, not at all.
Together, the workers create an environment that showcases their pride for poultry that is sure to leave you coming back for seconds.
I don't know if I would ever be able to work in a kitchen. I would be too tempted to eat everything. With the rise of the revolutionary food snaps and accounts on social media, I've actually seen so many pictures of food from the Dirty Bird, so I can imagine that the chefs are working up a storm to feed all the hungry Torontonians trying to keep up with the social media food trends.
Very true. Up next, we meet a trailblazer in the Canadian Correctional Services. Deborah Newman started off as a probation and parole officer in the 1970s. Battling sexism and sexual harassment, she made her way up from officer to manager to superintendent, and finally, Ontario's Deputy Minister of Correctional Services and Community Safety. Now retired, Newman sat down with reporter Alina Gosh to share her story.
So he shows up at the institution, and he came in and he said, darling, can you get me a coffee? And I before I could say anything else, he said, two creams and a sugar. And he said, and can you find the deputy superintendent for me? And I looked at him and I said, you're talking to her, and get your own coffee. I applied for my first position in corrections as a probation and parole officer when I was 23. It was in 1979. Women just started to work as correctional officers around that time when I was beginning my career. So this was a whole new role for women. It was groundbreaking. I think in my early 20s, I was a little naive, and I think I underestimated how challenging it was to be a woman working in a very military-like, male-dominated career path. My wake-up call was I had finished my master's degree in criminology, and I was applying for positions as probation and parole officer in Ontario, and I was interviewed by an all-white male panel for the position, and the panel were having a great time commenting on each one of the female candidates' physical appearance. So as I was walking in, I could hear them laughing and joking about the woman who was interviewed before me, and then I could hear them talking about me as I was walking out. It was a very male-dominated, very hierarchical, militaristic kind of environment to work in, and you were quite isolated as a woman. You didn't have very many female colleagues at all. There were actually virtually no female role models for you as a woman. You were not, one of the boys, and so you were excluded from a lot of conversations and a lot of social activities outside of the workplace. I think of when I was a deputy superintendent at one particular prison, and I was acting as the superintendent for a couple of months while the superintendent was on an assignment, and when he came back, he assembled the entire management team in the boardroom, so there were about 20 men and me, and he said to me, did you have a good time while I was away having ladies' cosmetic parties? When I became a superintendent, all of my colleagues in all the other prisons were men. My boss in those days never called me by my name. He always called me Sunshine. So it was those were the kind of conditions at that time. Some of the men that I worked with, either supervising them or reporting to them, were very fair and very progressive, but there was an undercurrent of sexism and sexual harassment. I certainly experienced sexual harassment myself, and I knew of other women who experienced sexual harassment and even sexual assault in those days. By superiors and sometimes by male colleagues. women who did report, and there was a real disincentive to complain, because what typically happened is if you complained, you were seen as the troublemaker and you were ostracized, alienated by the male colleagues that you worked with and by management. There was a very unfortunate situation in the 90s where at the Correctional Staff Training College there were allegations that female correctional officers had been sexually assaulted and harassed by male correctional officers who were there in training. And so a judicial inquiry was called into these allegations of criminal conduct. And I was asked to come into the deputy minister's office to undertake a complete review and overhaul of correctional policies, to establish workplace discrimination and harassment prevention policies, to look at the staff training college practices. And so I was able to be on the ground floor of making some systemic change in the culture of corrections. I think as a woman, you really did have to work much harder than your male colleagues in order to advance, to have credibility, to be seen as a respected professional. So I did that. I worked very hard. I took on every possible assignment that I could, extra assignments, additional responsibilities. And ultimately, I did receive opportunities, and I found opportunities and sought out opportunities myself. So through a combination of those things and through support from some very fair-minded colleagues, both men and women, over time, I was able to advance through the ranks of correctional services. Today, I would say there's definitely been progress made since I started out in my career. There are policies now around workplace discrimination and harassment, and that kind of conduct is no longer tolerated. It's dealt with, and people are held accountable, which was not the case back then. Certainly, sexual discrimination and harassment still occurs, but it's not as prevalent as it used to be, and it's dealt with. And there are a lot of efforts to promote diversity and inclusion. There are policies around accommodation of parenting and family responsibilities. So it's a more women-friendly environment than it used to be. It's a microcosm, really, of the sexism in society, but it's more pronounced in these kinds of environments. So it's a journey, and it's not over. It needs to be continued.
It's great to hear how things have improved for women entering this field. The industry I'm trying to eventually get into was also once dominated by men.
To tell you a little bit about our hosts, we're both currently journalism students at Ryerson University, balancing work, homework, a social life, and eating somewhere in between.
It's not easy to try and break into the journalism industry, or any industry for that matter, and get your dream job. I had the pleasure of sitting down with three individuals, a media student, graduate, and professional, to hear their perspectives about the media industry and what it takes to get to where they want to go.
My name is Riyad Mohammed. I'm a fourth-year integrated media student at OCAD University. I really want to work in production, either like a production manager or director.
Hi, my name is James Fisk. My current occupation is playout operations for Nextologies. My responsibilities include 24-hour programming for file-based channels. So a lot of that entails everything from the graphics you see come on your television to advertise the next show coming up, like when you're watching television and you see something like
say you're watching Fox and you see like an ad pop up for like The Simpsons and like the bottom of the screen, I'm responsible for stuff like that.
Hi, my name is Linda Costanza. I'm currently a full-time employee with the Bank of Montreal in a management position. I went to school at Humber College studying radio and broadcasting.
Well, for the last 2 years, I've really been working on building a portfolio by doing internships and unpaid shoots, and really just kind of working on this weekends to do whatever I can to build my portfolio so I have something to show when I go into wherever I want to apply to and have the work that really stands out from the other people who are applying. I definitely don't think I'm going to be getting into the career position, the actual final goal that I want, but rather a position that will eventually lead to that goal. I think really with just like every other job, you kind of have to work your way up. You can't just start in the top position.
100% is like an understatement. Like it, you have to devote your life to this. Basically, once you're in, and you don't leave work like physically and mentally. I really had to stand out. There's millions and millions of people that go to school for this kind of stuff, and it's a competition for sure. And then also the fact that getting the experience doesn't usually entail getting paid.
It's no longer about specializing in just one thing. You're expected to be able to write, edit, and even though I'm applying for to be a radio host, you're expected to know everything else that goes along in that field.
Well, I think a lot of people believe that there's just nothing that really goes into production in general. A lot of people believe that they can pick up an iPhone and just shoot exactly what we're shooting, when really there's so much budgeting and so much more equipment, and how like picky everyone is in the production field compared to what people actually see, is there's a huge contrast, and it's not really easy for people to understand all the effort that goes into production.
Outsiders view my job as if it's a walk in the park. I have the easiest thing to do in the world. Oh, must be so nice to just like go press a button, just do this, just sit back, when they have no idea how much money you have to invest, how much time you have to invest, all the people that you have to go, the parameters from even like setting it up, obtaining the right shots, the formatting, like the structure. That there's so many things, and people just think, oh, because I can record a video on my phone, I can throw it up online. Oh, it must be so easy. Or download an app. They don't realize what really goes into editing, what goes into broadcast standard. They'll never understand unless they've actually done it themselves. Like my own family has, like, really, no matter what I do or show them, they'll never truly understand what I'm doing for a living.
I definitely don't think I'm going to be getting into the career position, the actual final goal that I want, but rather a position that will eventually lead to that goal. I think really with just like every other job, you kind of have to work your way up. You can't just start in the top position.
I found myself struggling to get interviews, which I did. I got interviews, but I never got any callback. It was a huge struggle. And I just find that it was very unfair looking back, because, you know, I never had the chance to actually prove myself in that field. And even though I have the passion and the drive to be in that field, it was just very, really hard and disappointing.
It is an art, but it is a skill at the same time. And I've spent hours and hours and hours on a project and poured my heart and soul into it. And then my production coordinator and manager could turn around and hate what I've done, or they like it, I like it, and then the client doesn't like it. And it's just stressful, because it's numbing. After a while, you've like looked at it, heard the same voices, and done like millions of cuts and color corrected, stabilized, you've gone out, or even when you've gone to an event and say if something happens or you didn't get it, it's a live event, there it's a one shot, like you can't go back. There's only so much you can fix and post. It can be very daunting and stressful, but then it can be very beautiful and humbling at the same time too, especially if you're the only one who was there to capture like the moment and no one else was able to. You get to share that after with the world, and it's there forever.
was an interesting look into the industry, Chelsea. It really is a very challenging field to enter. And I know you're graduating next year, too. What are you doing to prepare?
I'm just trying to take every job opportunity that comes my way. I've got 3 jobs right now and 2 unpaid internships, and it's all so tiring to balance. But I know if I don't put in the work now, I may not have anything to actually put work into in the future. So stressful to think about that all, especially the future. But anyways, that's it for our show. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll be back next week with more.
Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday, eat lots, work a little less, and we hope you tune in again.